Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the final weekly update of 5774. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. You're really not on next week?
Yeah, believe it or not. I'll be on in Staten Island if you want to come out and hear Musaf. But then you'd have to come out for three days, right? And the Verrazano and all that, you know, if you're actually going to walk it, that would be a problem. Have you yet revealed where you'll be for Rosh Hashanah? What your plans are?
I'll be in Woodcliff Lake.
Woodcliff? That's New Jersey?
That is.
You'll be in New Jersey this coming Rosh Hashanah. So that was some year, 5774, wasn't it?
It still is, yes. And it seems to be one of those years that's not going out with a whimper, but till the last minute going to continue to give us surprises.
Now, and I like to emphasize that, and it's interesting, I visited a couple of communities over the last few weeks. I'm impressed by the security at some of the larger synagogues in our metropolitan area on Shabbos morning, and I'm assuming that in many places that will continue, obviously, for the high holidays, and as we like to point out, you always reassure us that those who are responsible for our safety and take it very seriously in places like New York and New Jersey are on full alert, so to speak, with the high holiday season in full swing.
It's true, not just in New York and New Jersey. In many parts of the country, I think there's a new seriousness, and given the threats and the fact that ISIS and others have said they will take the attacks abroad, and that there have been groups discovered. There was a group in Denmark recently in the last week, and others that are linked to these threats. So we take it seriously, and the shuls and the communities have to take it seriously. And if we see something, say something, don't hesitate. It's better to be wrong than sorry.
Yeah, no question about that. I was reading before the Scotland vote was revealed, and the results was, you know, started pouring in, that it would be, and explain this to me, because it seems like, I mean, I always emphasize this, how it's all about, you know, for us, the effect on Israel, and, you know, good for the Jews, bad for the Jews. Apparently, a secession from the UK by Scotland, which is now not going to be the case, was viewed as bad for Israel. Could you explain that?
Well, secession, number one, it brings elements of that are not determinable now. Second, the government of Scotland has tended to be quite anti-Israel. It's a very liberal left orientation, and people were concerned about the kind of government that would emerge. They've made statements that are very disturbing in the past, not during the necessarily particularly concerned. And I know that many people in shuls around the world were concerned.
And could you explain why, especially with the type of government or the type of citizenry that you just described in Scotland, why didn't the vote go through? From a political science point of view, why was it shot down yesterday?
Well, I think we'll find out as they do assessments and more of the exit polling is analyzed. But they successfully, scared a lot of the older people that their financial situation would be jeopardized. And their exclusion from the EU, that they would not be given membership, and that they would face a lot of uncertainty. You know, the nationalistic feelings were great. The fact that they got 46% of the vote is not something that would have been predicted before.
Right.
And the amount of fervor that was expressed and continues to be expressed even after the defeat, but saying that this is not over, not likely to be a vote again, as the Prime Minister of England said, in this generation, some said in a lifetime, but it has unleashed something which I think is not going to be going away so quickly, and the government of England is going to have to deliver on the promises about greater autonomy for Scotland and greater control over their own dealings, especially economic.
Fascinating, especially in light of how long they've been together. Since when did Al-Qaeda, or ISIS in this case, establish a presence in Australia?
Australia has been a target for a long time of Muslim immigration, including terrorists. They've been on the alert for quite a while. But it's not just Australia. Australia is visible right now, but we've seen it popping up in Brussels. You saw it with the attack attack on the museum in France. We've seen it in, as I said, in Denmark or Sweden, other places where the alerts have gone out, people being warned about the growth of this of ISIS presence. But it's and you add to that Hezbollah, which has a worldwide footprint, and you have Hamas, which has presence in other places, not as much, and none of it, I think, is comparable to Hezbollah, which I think is probably the largest. But Al Qaeda, in its new incarnation or continuing presence, is not centrally located, and they are not as territorial. They didn't look to capture territory. ISIS, ISIL, ICE, it goes to control specific areas and focused first in Syria, then in Iraq, and trying to consolidate their hold on greater and greater amount of territory. We see it this week in Yemen, which, as you know, I discussed on the show, and people, I'm sure, glazed over asking where Yemen was. They didn't know it still existed. They had heard about it many years ago. Well, what I talked about a couple of weeks ago took place this week. The Houthis, who are a terrorist organization, they're Zaydi Shiites, supported by Iran, a wholly owned subsidiary of Iran, I would say, who for years have been the proxy in the Iranian-Saudi war, attacking Saudis across the border. The Saudis have bombed the border with Yemen many times, have taken raids against the Houthis. Well, they have moved into the capital. They're now on a street called Thalathin, which is a major thoroughfare going into the capital, and they've been holding protests and had, like, protest cities inside the capital to topple the government. They now control the whole area from the capital, Sana'a, to the Saudi border. Now, if you're sitting in Saudi Arabia and you see this, this has to be very unsettling, and that it gives Iran the foothold that it wants in the Arabian Peninsula so it can go against Oman next. But most importantly, you have the Straits, and controlled by Bab al-Mandab, which is part of Yemen. They could control, together with Somalia, which is on the other side, and also a radical Islamist regime, but the shipping where 60 or 70% of the oil to the West goes through, and everything coming from the Gulf area.
Are there any Arab states that would like to see them? I mean, I'm sure many would like to see them stop this infiltration into places like Yemen, but there's nobody who can go ahead and control them at this point.
Well, they are a tribe that has been there, but you also have the tribal groups in Yemen who are now more Muslim Brotherhood oriented, who were fighting before, but the Houthis have managed to fight off the counter-response. The Yemeni's army seems to be very, very weak. Now they're negotiating with the Houthis. Officials are negotiating with them. They have surrounded a lot of the institutions of the Sunni Islam Party, including taking university, the TV station. Dozens have been killed in the past few days. And again, people have to understand the significance of each of these things, that what hardly gets any coverage, Iran gets coverage, and everybody understands Iraq's a big country, oil, etc. Yemen is a critical country, too, and it gets no coverage. And the expansion of the Islamist influence, and in not only in the Middle East, but in Africa today, in other parts of the world. So your question, you know, is an important one, that people see the spread and how the tentacles are reaching out globally.
Wow.
Look at the reports about Texas from Midland, Texas, the police chief, and you can buy, you don't have to buy, but look at the reports about the area on the Mexican-Texas border, Ciudad Juarez, I think it's called, and they talk about the Islamists, how IS has a presence there.
You know what I'm doing now. I'm obviously looking at a map to see what you're describing on the border of
turn it upside down.
On the border of the Arabian Sea.
Right.
It's unbelievable. You control that area. You control everything, essentially.
It's critically important.
By the way, I started with Australia, and I'm sure you understand why, because, you know, the common folk, including myself, you know, as much as we've seen Europe become overrun, and obviously we know about the presence in South America, and you continue to describe what's going on in the United States, we've always had this impression, like if there's going to be, you know, that Muslim radicalism is never going to get to Australia. I didn't realize, based on the news of this week, that it's been like this already for over a decade.
It has. I did talk about it, Dave, the immigration from the islands, from Indonesia, from Malaysia, ongoing, not necessarily Islamists, but amongst them many Islamists. And they have had problems with the threat of terror and with some incidents for a long time. And they, you know, the governments there have been outspoken about dealing with it. That it has not been, you know, the kind of quiet approach to it.
Yeah. You know, the White House, and I don't know if you ever think of this, but this came to my mind last night. There's no proper reaction to the beheadings. And I mentioned this because in Australia, that was one of their goals, right? To find a random person and again, do one of these, you know, international videos of a beheading, right? That was the goal of the group.
That's what they said.
Right. So in the White House, for instance, and I assume leadership in other democratic countries, it seems there's no effective response. And I don't just mean strategically, I mean symbolically. What is the president, I know there are a lot of critics of the president in this audience, but what is the president of the United States supposed to do? What is supposed to be the proper reaction when these madmen, or one in particular who we keep seeing in the videos, is frightening the entire world with these brutal acts? What would you like to see the president of the United States, you know, how should he be responding in a symbolic sense? It seems that no matter what he says, it's completely ineffective and nobody thinks that they can stop this.
Well, I think the problem with the West is that their responses are always symbolic. I don't want symbolic responses. I want action. We should have taken action a long time ago in Syria, and it doesn't mean having to put you know, boots on the ground, even though we already now have boots on the ground. We admit to 1,500 in Iraq. They're going to need more support. The answer is that we should have identified people at the very beginning. Now we're going to go give aid, and we have nobody in Syria who I think is a worthy recipient. It's going to be so hard to identify anybody with whom we can work.
How did Congress fell for that? That's the first thing I thought of when I heard about aid to the rebels.
Well, there's a lot of concern, and they want to do something, and this, you know, seems like a most reasonable approach, and it's why Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, voted for it. And I understand it, Nate, but, you know, that the beheadings are taking place in Gaza. They're taking place in Syria. They took place in Lebanon recently. It's becoming a phenomenon around the world because they saw the success that ISIS had with it, that it, rather than causing the revulsion that we react to it amongst young Muslims, it became a rallying call. It became a recruitment tool, and there are just reports of Americans from Minnesota, especially Somali families in the St. Paul, Minnesota region, boys and girls going to the region. They say that 15 to 20 young women, and I know that Britain said 60, and there are perhaps 300 Western women who are fighting with ISIS, and most, many of them are members of the Modesty Patrol or other enforcement operations. And these beheadings became recognized as something that excited, that something that showed determination, and the way that they carried out with the guy standing there holding neck and using it to make a statement has gone viral, and it becomes an increasingly accepted practice that people now compete to who's beheaded more people.
That's what's unbelievable. We got to get a psychiatrist on during this update 1 week to explain this phenomenon. Is it the violence? Is it the revolutionary aspect? What is it that this recruitment tool has been so effective in so many countries?
Well, you have preachers and imams who are preaching this, who support it, who say that this is the force that is spreading the word of Islam, that they see, you know, the corruption in a lot of the Muslim countries. They see the failures in a lot of the countries, and they're saying, here's a force. Look, they took on the West. They took on Assad. They are on the ascendancy. They just took 21 Kurdish villages in the last 2 days and are attacking another city in Syria. And that the successes and the fact that the West attacks them and only enhances the image that they have and becomes more attractive to young people, as I mentioned once on the air, that there were hundreds of young Frenchmen went to Syria and said they were Muhammad Mara fighters. They went, this is the guy who killed the three little children outside the Jewish school and the soldiers and the rabbi. And they were inspired by his action, but the way you give expression to it is to go there. They also recruit very widely, and you can't tell the recruitment because often it's done by domestic residents.
I know, but some of you mentioned Somalia, and certainly anybody with a certain background, we might be able to understand it. Unless Facebook's completely false, it's the regular American kids that are getting involved with it, which is so hard to believe.
Muslims. It's not attracting, except for some converts or, you know...
Right, those are the exceptions.
Far-out people. It isn't attracting general American young people to the thing. They're troubled people, perhaps, but
right.
I wouldn't say that it has an appeal to a broader audience.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, around the world on the web, jmam.org. May I share with you the campaign slogan of senatorial candidate Robert Ransdell in Kentucky? May I share with you his campaign slogan?
Okay.
With Jews, we lose.
Right.
What do you think?
It rhymes, but I know about it. I think they've repealed it, and he's an extremist candidate. And
At this point, he's a write-in candidate.
The wrong end candidate.
But just the fact that, I don't know, I mean, I know that, you know, we certainly have a history in this country of plenty of episodes and incidents, but I don't know, it's 2014, and you'd think that, you know, we've gotten past all this, and sure enough, a guy can get national attention and essentially been given the, you know, the freedom of speech routine by media outlets, you know, in this day and age.
No, I think he's been treated as an isolate case. And a fringe candidate, but you're right. The very fact that this becomes even feasible today, but unfortunately, and when I say it, I know people say, you know, it's depressing, it's scary to hear all of this.
Yeah.
We're coming into Rosh Hashanah. They're going to start looking at the fact that in France you have a doubling in numbers, in Britain a tripling of the numbers of anti-Semitic incidents.
Correct, and it's coming to the U.S. even more.
And it's here, and it's on our campuses, and we have...
And the future of the Jewish peoples in the state of Israel.
at campus forums and other places where you hear the kind of anti-Israel stuff with no balance about the real facts, and much of the media feeds it, too.
And the future of the Jewish peoples in the state of Israel. And did I mention that the future of the Jewish people is in the state of Israel? You know, back to a second on this congressional vote. Last week you described for us essentially, unless I didn't get it right, and believe me, it's possible with the way things are going these days in trying to keep track of everything in the Middle East, you basically described three sides, right? That was the conclusion we came to in Syria, that we always thought there's two sides to this, but essentially now there's three sides because you don't know who Assad is going to align himself with politically in his country, right?
He won't align himself with any of those parties. He allies himself with Hezbollah.
So now when the U.S. says, okay, aid to the rebels, which of the three sides is that money going to?
And I would say that there's much more than three sides. If you take a look just what's going on in the Golan, where al-Nusra, which is an al-Qaeda offshoot, if you remember, was al-Qaeda in Syria, they control most of the crossings and most of the border area, including some of the crossings between Israel and Syria, and are increasing their presence there. IS is said to have individuals, but they don't have a military presence there, but the Syrian army was routed from that area. Then you have perhaps 30, 40 different rebel groups, plus you have ISIS controlling Raqqa and the area. And now, because they think the United States is going to bomb, they removed all of their fighters, families, and their offices and other things, and they move underground. They have the tunnels, they have facilities, you know, in hidden places. So they move them out of Raqqa, but out Raqqa is where the oil is and which they are selling back to the Assad regime, which they're fighting, through Kurdish middlemen, and it all goes out through Turkey. And when the U.S. has been pressuring Turkey to stop it, they haven't. And that's another subject. So,
so when the U.S.
Syria
says
itself, then you have the Free Syrian Army, which is
right.
Very
so when the U.S. announces the Syrian rebels are getting the money, who's getting it?
They have to determine which groups they can work with.
It's almost impossible.
It's very hard, and because you know the truth is, you have opposition outside with whom I've met, but they're not the ones fighting on the ground. The Free Syrian Army was our ally initially. It's weak. It hasn't produced. It produced very little. So now you have a conglomeration. In some cases, they've merged together, many under ISIS, but we're not going to help ISIS and its affiliates. And therefore, we have to really carefully identify.
Right.
Because look how the arms have flowed now. You know, in the Golan, they took over the UN presence there, and all the soldiers ran into Israel. So now you have these terrorists have UN uniforms, UN vehicles, UN weapons. So you're not going to know when somebody approaches and you see a guy in a UN uniform whether it's a terrorist or it's a UN peacekeeper.
That's why I'm telling you, that's why I was shocked that no prominent U.S. senator got up and simply said, what are we doing? Do we even know who this is going to go finance?
Oh, they have said it. There were many who got up and expressed reservations. They want to show that they support the president and they want the president to take tougher action in the instance, but I think this is something where American intelligence and others are playing a role, working with the parties on the ground to see. Look, you know, we said we cleared it of chemical weapons, Syria,
and they got them.
Now they're fighting. No, they're finding. The Israelis say there are rocket-propelled grenades, missile warheads, bombs with chemical weapons on it, probably sarin.
But whatever gave us the assurance that they had gotten rid of them?
Right. That's a good question. And the Syrians admitted that they had a research and development facility plus laboratories producing ricin, which they had not disclosed before. And so after the world is convinced that everything is out of there, we're finding that they still have this, and they retained stockpiles of chemical weapons.
You know what I'm surprised about, by the way? Who has been more outspoken to the world about the situation with Iran and nuclear capability than the leaders of Israel? It's obviously, you know, led by the prime minister. When it comes to ISIS and its influence now in the Middle East, you would think that Israel would be more outspoken about what must be done in order to defeat them, and it's been relatively quiet on that issue.
Well, because anything Israel says or does becomes a tool for the other side to mobilize people and say, you see, it's really a Zionist plot, it's the Israelis. And they say it all the time, by the way, about everything that goes on. So Israel has to be somewhat careful. Also, Israel doesn't have a presence on the ground. They do share intelligence with the United States and West because of satellites and others. And also because they understand that, as al-Zawahiri said, it's Damascus first, then Jerusalem. This is a holy war. And the holy war for them means recreating. Their name was ISIL initially.
Right.
That wasn't Lebanon, it was the Levant.
Right.
And Levant includes all of what was then Palestine, meaning Israel, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. That's their goal, is to create a caliphate. And when IS, now the Islamic State, really means the establishment of a caliphate in the region, that's their goal.
And the president got criticized for using ISIL. And, if you know, on Israel's side, isn't it better that someone as high-profile as him use that expression? Because, again,
if people knew what it meant, it might be
it might be
better,
helpful.
But, you know, nobody really knows. And it should be explained, because first they used to say it stands for Syria and Lebanon, and it didn't. And then it was ISIL when it was Iraq and Syria, and Iraq and Lebanon, at Levant.
Right.
So then the transformation of the name, now it's just IS because they want everything.
Right. That's why if it's Damascus first and then Jerusalem, you would think that, but maybe you're right, that in an outgoing public manner, there's no need to. I have to assume that Israel, through intelligence and through military presence, whatever that means, is taking whatever precautions possible on their own borders when it comes to ISIS, because they know what you just said, that Jerusalem is in fact next.
Well, certainly they bolstered their presence there greatly. The groups operating like al-Nusra don't want to start up with Israel yet, but there's every expectation that they could heat up. this, and Israel will be very strong in the response. There'll be no holding back. They also have to worry about the Lebanon border with Hezbollah's huge presence with 100,000 missiles and with the tunnels that they're looking for and at. Israel is monitoring all of this. The intelligence is very extensive, their physical presence there. And at the same time, they set up a field hospital to treat Syrians.
Yeah.
Almost 400 of them have come to Israeli hospitals. And yesterday, a leader of the Syrian opposition, who's outside of Syria now, went to visit some of the Syrians in the hospitals in Haifa, and he said publicly that Assad is slaughtering us and Israel is healing us.
Unbelievable. Talk about a message for the new year. By the way, you think there'll be a new airport in northern Israel? Is that an international airport? Is Israel going to have a second international airport in the near future?
If an international airport that we're talking about using the one in the south, but there is talk about developing one as an alternative.
Yeah, I read about the Galil that they were thinking about.
About the Galil, right. But it's very hard because you need a lot of land to build. Airports are huge. You know, when you come into the area of Ben-Gurion, you know, you drive for quite a while from
right.
this point.
I just think it's another, and again, great message for the last, weekly update of the year. I just think it's unbelievable that Israel might be at the stage, just a small country, and sometimes we forget, might be at the stage where they need and would be able to grow even further. Imagine what it would do for the north of Israel if there was a second international airport. And you always point out that, you know, there's a lot of good news to share out there. And one of it is if you look at the last year, 5774, the growth in Israel in so many areas has been unbelievable.
And you know that Malaysia and Indonesia, the biggest countries, Muslim countries, their trade is skyrocketing with Israel. Even during the war, it didn't stop. It wasn't diminished at all. And that was the good news, that Israel's economy was able to withstand the pressures of this latest conflict, though we're going to see much more efforts about the boycott and PA Abbas coming to New York this week to press unilateral actions, whether it's the International Criminal Court, the threat of the International Criminal Court. But we'll use this vehicle to remind him that if he does that, he's the one who could end up being in the docket on charges of war crimes. It was his partner. They played too much of a role in a lot of this stuff, so he better be wary about what he does. But the unilateral actions, which could cost him U.S. aid, and then he'll present himself as being the victim of Israeli intransigence. And his goal is to isolate Israel globally and to increase pressure so he doesn't have to negotiate. He wants the U.N. to negotiate and to be the mediator, not the U.S., to deliver for him. So he doesn't have to make any concessions.
Yeah, well, the only flaw with that argument that, you know, we'd be able to hold his feet to the fire is that he has a lot of anti-Israel allies on his side, you know, who would be more than happy to help him progress in this area of criminal...
There's one thing at the UN. There's another thing at the ICC, which has also had tendencies to be anti-Israel. Any UN agency virtually is already stacked against Israel. But the question of their standing, do they have the right to bring it? In the past, the court has said no. And in fact, one of the key people in the court, who was on the court, has now become, has come to the other side in terms of the arguments that he's put forward publicly about it. So it's not a slam dunk for him.
You talked about trade relations a moment ago with Israel, Malaysia, etc. Someone told me, is it true that the Technion, and maybe it was a different technical institution in Israel, maybe it was not Technion, but there's a significant Asian population among the student body in a place like Technion?
Absolutely.
Which is unbelievable.
Chinese students fight to come to Israel. There's a delegation from China there almost every week. I am in touch with people in China, and they all want to have a piece of Israel. You know, they bought into Teva, I think it was.
Right. Yeah, one of those pharmaceuticals.
And they bought into, but they bought it, that was high profile, they bought
right.
into many other firms. And what do they want from Teva? They want their cows. And it's not because they want the milk from the cows, they want the cows to teach, to learn and to have the secret about why do Israeli cows produce so much more milk? And China's needs are endless. But they're also their creativity, their respect for Jews, the interest in Israel. And when I was in China, and there are organizations in Israel that work to promote the relationship between China and Israel, and they tell me that they have 10 applicants for every slot that they can give somebody at a university in Israel. And there's, you know, there are now cadres of Hebrew-speaking Chinese who have gone back to China and who maintain the ties. That's why there's a great deal of work in the high-tech area and other areas between China and Israel. And of course, the expansion, the broad expansion of the trade with India, and the new Prime Minister of India, with whom, God willing, we will meet in the coming week, who's extremely supportive and appreciative of Israel.
I told you, I think I told you this, a suggestion of a friend of mine that China should take over Israel. All of a sudden, you'd see the Israeli military grow like crazy.
But they will take them all back to China.
I don't know about that. Maybe they'd want to fly the flag in the Middle East.
Well, China, when they go into countries generally, is to remove the resources. Mm. And part of the reason you have such a backlash in Africa against them is because they buy huge swaths of land, produce food, but they don't leave it there for domestic production or even to make money domestically. They take it all back to China, and that creates a lot of resentment. We're in these countries that need the food as well.
One of our listeners corrected that it was the Tanuva purchase that
Tanuva
that made the not Teva,
got the cows, right?
Right, not the Teva made farmers. Teva.
But one seeing another is
Before I turn to you for our Rosh Hashanah message, because the brand new year of 5775 is upon us. Angela Merkel goes to an anti-Semitism a rally against anti-Semitism in Berlin and speaks, and I am told that it's not like here in the United States where public officials and obviously someone as high profile as her, you know, can get up at a rally like that and not be met with tremendous criticism. So on one end, we see obviously the problems that the Jewish communities of Europe are having right now. On the other end, we see to a large degree there are public officials in Europe willing to stand up.
Well, she has been very supportive all along, and the fact is that not only she, but the president of Germany, and this is very rare, that the two would be in one place at one time, and made very strong statements. It was focusing on anti-Semitism, and they had 5,000-7,000 people showed up. That is remarkable. You have some other leaders who have spoken out against the anti-Semitism, some of the people beginning to recognize the price you pay for all of this. But more leaders have to speak out, and they have to act. They have to prosecute. They have the laws there are different than here with group libel, so you can prosecute. Less different definition of freedom of speech.
Right.
And so her presence there was very significant.
Rosh Hashanah message as we wrap up the year. What would you like to see the rabbis discuss Thursday from the pulpit, Malcolm, if someone wants to give an important message to open people's eyes as to what's happening in this world of ours? What should the message be from our leaders this coming Rosh Hashanah?
Look, part of the purpose of Rosh Hashanah is we commit ourselves to the coming year. And then during the Aseret Yemei Tshuva and Yom Kippur, we look to the last year and tried to do tshuva for what repent for what we did wrong. But Rosh Hashanah has a different content in the tefillah where we don't have those elements. And I think that if I really had the opportunity to influence all the rabbis, and we have did something this week with briefings by Frank Luntz, who just completed a study of the campuses in America and the very disturbing results. Really shook up the Conference of Presidents when he addressed them about and showed them the charts and the reaction, is to have the rabbi speak from the pulpit, and this means everybody, and give them the arguments. Tell them what they have to go out and say, to charge them now, because we're going to face these challenges, get people to understand their responsibility, that each of them has an ability to influence and to make a difference. And if we're looking to the year ahead, not just to the past year, to think about how do we in this year meet that responsibility? How do we show, because so many of the fields are future-oriented. If you look at the words, and really people don't just say them, but try to understand the challenge. It looks back, but it also looks forward. That this year, more than ever, we have to educate our young kids, and that we have to orient them and to tell them what the arguments are, and that rabbis have pulpits in which to say to people, don't fall into the traps, and this is for all rabbis across the board, that to warn people about what the real issues are and why people have to be alert, and that no one can say, like it, when it comes to tzedakah, when it comes to anything else, that it's somebody else's responsibility, that, you know, they'll wait till somebody else does it. This is a time of, and the challenges that we discuss now and the many more that we have discussed them throughout the year. And people shouldn't say, oh, this is depressing to look at it. Jews have to face reality.
Well, you just mentioned something about being depressed when you saw research results. Is that something the public's going to be able to see in the near future?
We're not going to publish it because we're not going to feed the enemy. But the those who work on campus, those who work in communities, all the leadership.
I mean, can it be worse than we think the average college campus is now? I mean, most of us have a pretty negative impression about the attitude toward Israel on college campuses.
And amongst young Jews, even on the...
Even amongst young Jews. Even amongst young Jews.
This is all so, so important.
Hey.
And even those who come from families that are committed and from even some with good Jewish educations, but the schools are not equipping them, and especially those with high school students. And you know how long I've urged this.
Yep.
But I would tell you that if we're doing introspection, we have to look at it as a klal. We look at this not just in our personal circumstances, but we do a retrospection about the community. And this year, with all the challenges and opportunities, there is a lot of good news. There is a lot that we can be proud of and that we have to teach our kids to be proud to talk about. Look at all the discoveries and teach them about them, showing our roots in Israel for thousands of years, verified and re-verified and re-verified, and the Tanakh coming to life in these new excavations and discoveries, because of the Kodesh Baruch Hu. God is sending us these signals. You just got to wake up to it and realize it. He's saying, look, I give you all these opportunities, and giving you all these blessings, and giving you all of things that your grandparents and great-grandparents didn't have. Now show you're worthy of it. And I hope that people will at least take some time to think about it and to consider their responsibility, Klal, not just to themselves and to their families, which, of course, is primary, but so is it, because we're all going to have the same fate.
Take this opportunity to wish you and your family a happy, healthy, and sweet new year, Mr. Honlein. I hope we have the chance to do this for another year together.
God willing, and Yerushalayim, and we'll be able to celebrate there together. This will be the year, and if not, then we'll keep praying for
it. And we'll just keep going, Bezrat Hashem. I thank you. Have a wonderful Shabbos. There he is, Malcolm Honlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Next week's, obviously, Rosh Hashanah. Erev Yom Kippur will speak together. 2 weeks from today, and there'll be a lot to cover for the end of September. 2 weeks from today, we will reconvene for our weekly update.